Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do Chapter 8 of The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds by Robert S. Griffin, professor up at the University of Vermont, who did what he called a portrait of William Luther Pierce a couple of years before he died. Everything that we do can be found at vnnforum.com, and I'm Alex Linder, and I'm the proprietor of VNN Forum. I will be the reader today, and I will supply any supplemental commentary needed. But we're going to hear William Pierce talking to Robert Griffin about his The National Alliance. Chapter 8, The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. Chapter 8, The National Alliance. Pierce told me he was somewhat adrift for a few months after breaking from Kale and the National Socialist White People's Party in 1970. During this respite, he cemented in a conclusion that had been formulating for some time, that he needed to change his overall approach to things. He discontinued the journal he had been publishing, National Socialist World, after 6 issues, deciding that there was too small an audience for a theoretical journal of this kind. There was no National Socialist movement in this country, no organization to which people belonged, and a very limited number of people identified themselves with the National Socialist ideology. Plus, Pierce wanted to establish contact with a wider variety of people. Quote, I was certain there were many people around who didn't think of themselves as National Socialists, who were concerned about the same degenerative trends in politics and demographics as I was, and I wanted to find them. Beyond all that, he simply wanted to deal with people closer to the normal end of the stability and reliability spectrum than he had been for the past few years. There were too many crackpots where I had been, is the way he put it. One day, Pierce said, he was watching television, and he saw an interview with the chairman of an organization called the National Youth Alliance, a man by the name of Lou Byers. Pierce hadn't been familiar with either Byers or the National Youth Alliance prior to that time. Pierce learned from the television interview that the NYA was aimed at college students and oriented toward opposing the 1960s counterculture on campus. The NYA defined the counterculture as being characterized by anti-Vietnam War sentiment, sympathy toward recreational drug use, alignment with black militants, and a general anti-authority, anti-establishment posture. Basically, the NYA was a more radically conservative version of another organization, the Young Americans for Freedom, which had the endorsement of mainstream conservatives such as 1964 Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater. I want to talk to this Byers, Pierce said to himself. Even though Pierce wasn't at heart an organization type, and he certainly didn't like administrative work, nevertheless, he had decided he needed to link up with an organization of some kind, and this National Youth Alliance sounded as if it might be a good possibility. The Nazis weren't a good fit, but he couldn't really operate on his own without an organizational tie-in. He believed he could write well and get to the core of a matter, and that is the sort of thing people do on their own, but the problem was that he couldn't express what he wanted to express operating alone. You can't be a writer in a total vacuum, and what publisher would touch this kind of thing he wanted to write? Indeed, he needed an organizational context and support to get what he wanted to say out to the people he wanted to reach. Plus, even though he wasn't a people person, he did want to establish a dialogue with others, and being part of an organization, or running one, yes, having one of his own, would be a good way to proceed. Pierce arranged to meet with Byers and get the lowdown on the National Youth Alliance. It turned out that the person who set up the organization was a man by the name of Willis Carto. One of Carto's many activities, he is still growing strong in his 70s, was the formation of a publishing house, Noontide Press. A Noontide Press's book, which has gotten a good amount of attention in radical right circles, although it is unclear just how many have actually read this 680-page treatise, Pierce says he hasn't, is Imperium, written in Ireland in 1947 by an American by the name of Francis Parker Yockey. Carto wrote a lengthy introduction for the American publication of the book. Imperium is an Oswald Spengler-influenced call for the fight for the survival of the, quote, organic foundations of the Western soul, unquote, against the alien forces that have diseased it. Yockey's appearance, lifestyle, and persona have greatly heightened the interest in his largely derivative book. A slim, handsome, Ralphian Ralph Fiennes, or however you pronounce that, lookalike, the actor. He was this mysterious character who spent the 1950s traveling Europe and America, engaged in unspecified right-wing political activities, and making a living in some way or another. He was a lawyer by training. One undertaking of Yaki's that is known, he helped form a short-lived organization in London called the European Liberation Front. Reportedly, the FBI kept their eye on him. Cardo, who spent time with Yaki, described him in the introduction to Imperium as, quote, pensive, sensitive, and magnetic, and as possessing a quick, knowing intelligence, wrote Carto of Yaki. His eyes bespoke great secrets and knowledge and terrible sadness. Yaki's suitcase, which he had inadvertently left in a Fort Worth, Texas airport, was discovered to contain 7 British certificates, German press credentials, and American, Canadian, and British passports with the same photo but different names. His 1960 death at 43 in a San Francisco jail where he was being held on passport fraud is still the subject of speculation among those on the right fringe. Suicide by cyanide, as they say, or murdered by the CIA. Move on to page 114. Yaki was in the news in 1999 when he was invoked by John William King upon King's conviction and death sentence for a savage crime in Texas, which received extensive front-page national coverage. A black man, James Byrd, was picked up in the early morning hours while walking home from a party, driven to a country road, beaten and then chained by his ankles to a pickup truck, and dragged 3 miles to an agonizing death as his body was ripped to pieces. Pierce's name came up in the case when it was alleged that during the crime, King said something to the effect, "We are starting the Turner Diaries." After the verdict, King released a statement, "Though I remain adamant about my innocence, it's been obvious from the beginning that this community would get what they desire, so I'll close with the words of Francis Yaki. The promise of success is with the man who is determined to die proudly when it is no longer possible to live proudly." In 1968, Alabama Governor George Wallace ran as a third-party candidate for president on a populist platform. Cardo, Pierce told me, formed an organization called Youth for Wallace, and under that banner sent out letters asking for financial contributions. When the Wallace campaign ended, Cardo established a new organization, the National Youth Alliance, with a different mail drop in Washington, and gave it over to his employee, Lou Byers, B-Y-E-R-S. Using the mailing list Cardo had built up through the Youth for Wallace efforts, Byers sent out fundraising letters in the hundreds of thousands, according to Pierce. During his meeting with Byers, Pierce learned that things weren't going well for the NYA. Byers told him that it was going to fold up because the mailings were not bringing in enough money to cover their cost, and consequently the organization was going into the hole financially. Pierce said Byers told him that the NYA was $500,000 in debt and was within a couple months of running out of credit. Pierce said he told Byers he thought the National Youth Alliance was a good concept. There needed to be something that stood up in opposition to youth culture that was then being pushed so hard on campus and in the mainstream media. The idea was around that it was cool to show disrespect for authority, ridicule tradition and the government, live without personal discipline, and to do drugs. And large numbers of college students were being induced into taking the side of the enemy in the war that was then being staged in Vietnam. But Pierce asserted, you have to have a real organization and not just fundraising vehicle of some kind you've got now. You have to give something back to people who contribute their money. Pierce was thinking of demonstrations, activities on campus, that sort of thing, and particularly he had in mind a tabloid geared to young radicals. Pierce told Byers that he was interested in picking up the NYA and operating it as his own organization, and with Byers' advice and support, that is what he did. No formal transfer of ownership took place between Byers and Pierce. Byers had incorporated the NYA in the District of Columbia, but by the time he and Pierce met, he was working elsewhere, and in Pierce's words, the NYA in D.C. was, quote, stone dead, unquote. Pierce formed a corporation under that name in Virginia. He rented office space in Arlington, which is right across the river there from D.C., and went into business, as he puts it. He had Byers' name on his NYA letterhead as chairman of an advisory council. Byers had told him that an advisory council with familiar names would be helpful in bringing credibility to the organization. The other members of the advisory council were 2 retired military men, Navy Admiral John Crommelin, C-R-O-M-M-E-L-I-N, and Marine Corps Lieutenant General Pedro Del Valle, D-E-L, new word, V-A-L-L-E, and a classics professor from the University of Illinois by the name of Revelo P. Oliver. Pierce put together the first issue of a new tabloid he wrote and edited called Attack. He borrowed $2,000 from Byers to print it up and sent it to 15,000 people on a mailing list Byers provided him. Pierce describes the mailing as an, quote, instant success, as it brought in $6,000 return. This set Pierce on his way in the new venture. In 1974, he discontinued the National Youth Alliance and started the National Alliance, which involved forming a new corporation in Virginia. Dropping the youth designation in the title reflected a movement toward a broader, more inclusive orientation, Pierce says. Ever since, the National Alliance and William Pierce have, for all practical purposes, been synonymous. Pierce gave it his all to make the National Youth Alliance, his first independent organizational activity, a success. He worked from dawn till late at night and slept on a couch in his office Monday through Friday. He saw his wife and two boys only on the weekends. He had decided that in order to make it work, the NYA would have to be his top and, for all practical purposes, only priority, and that everything else, including his family and relationships and his own personal well-being, would have to be subordinated to it. This outlook and approach was consistent with the message he had internalized from the George Bernard Shaw play, Man and Superman, that had had such a big impact on him. We heard about that in an earlier chapter. This was his first real chance to live out Shaw's concept. The National Youth Alliance would be his vehicle for serving the life force. As Pierce saw it, what he achieved through the organization he would build was the only thing that really mattered in the larger scheme of things. Everything else paled in significance compared to this part of his life. Beyond the philosophical justification for giving himself totally to this endeavor, Pierce decided that it was realistic to do so given the facts of the situation he was in. His read of the circumstance was that if this venture, the NYA, was going to succeed, and he was by and large alone with it, building it up by himself, this organization that had failed in others' hands, it was going to take everything he had in him, all of his time and attention. He couldn't afford to expend any of his energies elsewhere. This work comes first and requires every ounce of me outlook, stemming from a servant of the life force, and these are long hyphenated streams, conception of the meaning of his life and reinforced by the perception that the facts of the immediate situation require it, took firm hold with Pierce in these early years of the National Youth Alliance. It is an outlook which has stayed with him to this day. Now, at an age when others are retired and tending to their gardens, Pierce works night and day. Several times I broached the possibility of his cutting back on some hours he spends on the job, and he didn't entertain the idea at all. No, I can't afford to do that, he would quickly insist. There's too much that needs to be done to cut back. It was clear to me that he really believes that. And I must say, he seems to bear up well physically and mentally to the incredibly long hours he puts in, and he appears to be happy in what he is doing. I never once heard him complain about the time he devotes to his work. Pierce told me his wife Patricia was virtually the sole breadwinner for the family throughout the 1970s. He said he spent those years dodging bill collectors and hanging on by my fingertips. He finally got to the point, he told me, where he could afford to pay himself $50 a month. He moved his location several times during the decade, eventually occupying a small building that had formerly been a watchmaker's establishment. As time went along, he was able to hire a secretary and buy the equipment which would enable him to do all of his printing in-house and save the time and cost of hiring it out. Producing and distributing the tabloid Attack, and its successor, another tabloid, this one called National Vanguard, which Pierce began publishing in 1978, was the central activity of the NYA/NA in those years. About the switch from Attack to National Vanguard, Pierce said that Attack seemed to him to be suited for a publication directed primarily at young people, and that National Vanguard seemed more appropriate for a wider audience. He said that he tried to upgrade the quality of the Alliance's publication and give the organization a more serious image as time went along. In particular, he tried to lower the level of bombast and sensationalism as the organization and he matured. Reflective of this change in approach, National Vanguard changed over from a tabloid to a slick paper magazine in 1982. The frequency of the publication of Attack/National Vanguard has been around 8 issues per year. At the present time, National Vanguard issues are not forthcoming. Pierce describes the magazine as being in, quote, suspended animation until he can find a new editor. That's what I actually went out there to talk to him about around this time. He says he simply doesn't have the time to devote to it. And when I saw him, he had, you know, literally feet stacks of I guess, mail and other material on his desk that he needed to get through. And he told me he needed to go through that and get a secretary, et cetera, before he really wanted to restart the magazine. So I don't know. I found him, to be perfectly honest, I found him slightly deceptive. Preparing and distributing the tabloid wasn't the NA's only activity during the early years. For one thing, they did some demonstrating. Pierce said they held some small demonstrations of their own and at other times would tag on to others' demonstrations as a way of promoting their ideas. Pierce cited an example of one of his own demonstrations. In 1975, Edward Levy, whom Pierce describes as a Jew with a far-left background, which included involvement with the National Lawyers Guild, had been named Attorney General by President Gerald Ford. Pierce said the alliance had about 20 pickets marching around the Justice Department with signs pointing out Levy's ethnicity and past affiliations, but that the media completely ignored them. And I think I'll add a little to what I just said. The reason I found him deceptive was I went out there, we had a very good meeting, and he didn't precisely offer me the job, but I said, give me 2 weeks to really think about it, because I was living in Missouri under certain circumstances. And I thought about it. To me, I didn't particularly want to live in West Virginia because I was happy in Missouri. But I called him back. I said, yeah, I'll do it. And at that point, he withdrew. He withdrew. Well, you know, I got to get a secretary. I got to clean. And the whole thing to me had a very strange sort of flavor in the end. That's all I'm saying. Because I was willing to go out there and do it. And I was qualified to do it. And you need to train up people who are able to carry on that kind of stuff. Pierce's problem as a manager was that he was not willing to, as someone who he hired to work for him later told me privately, he was not willing to give people their heads. He basically didn't trust anyone other than himself to do anything. And that, although he grew an organization bigger than anyone else and must be judged on those grounds, partly on those grounds, it never became what it truly could because he didn't bring enough quality people around him. Quality people are not going to simply brainlessly accept everything that you do. They're going to have a little bit of input themselves. And again, there, I'm not talking from my own case. I'm talking about someone who actually lived there and told me what the deal was, which was verified by what I saw. He was letting his secretary run him too much and basically micromanaging and not letting stuff go through, even to the extent of changing messages. He wouldn't really trust anyone else to do it. Even people of professional capacity who'd come down to join him. And I know that really frustrated at least one person. Just telling you what I saw, honest to God. And pick up where we were on page 117. More successful efforts, he said, were when 25 or so of his people would carry a huge banner during Vietnam War demonstrations in Washington. The banner said something to the effect that the United States, as Pierce put it to me, quote, ought to either nuke Hanoi or get the hell out of Vietnam. Pierce told me he sees war as deadly serious business. Young lives are being lost every day. If something so big is at stake, and the circumstances are such that you must get into a war, then you ought to go all out to achieve a decisive victory as rapidly as you can. Otherwise, don't get into it in the first place. No tiptoeing around. If you're going to fight, fight with every resource at your disposal. That is Pierce's position. It was a pretty common right-wing position back then. Another National Alliance activity was the Sunday night meetings, which began in 1975, when Pierce had offices large enough to accommodate the number of people who were attracted to them in the 20 to 30 range. Pierce would show films and give talks to set out the framework of beliefs behind the Alliance and its, that is to say, his vision of a good life and a good society. The Alliance also produced a series of comic books aimed at young people. The artwork is amateurish and the dialogue wordy and stiff. But then again, a great deal of time and effort must have gone into the preparation of these comic books, and they reflect the lengths Pierce is willing to go to get his message across. In 1987, he formed a separate corporation, National Vanguard Books, to handle all of his publishing and sales operations. Then there is the weekly radio program that dispenses his message, which began in 1991, American Dissident Voices. The program is carried on shortwave and on several AM stations around the country. The stations change and the number varies as the stations add and drop the controversial program. In 2000, there were 7 AM stations that reach areas of Arizona, Texas, Alabama, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Maine, and Florida. ADV broadcasts reach an estimated 100,000 people worldwide. Now, it's only on this many stations, and they are paying for that airtime, but even so, most of the stations they approach won't even sell them airtime. That's how afraid they are of the Jews. But here and there, he was able to find, as he told me, like one Italian guy just said, fuck you to the Jews. I don't know if they're mafia connected or what, but they were not concerned about them. They didn't care about their attitude. But a lot of them yielded Jewish pressure, and that's why it's only on a handful of AM stations. They literally won't even take money to put this material out. There's your free press for you. And of course, radio is licensed by the FCC, which has common carrier provisions, but they never seem to kick in when it's non-blacks or non-other minorities trying to apply them. At present, Pierce handles the radio show completely on his own. He writes the script in his office on his computer. A show runs 10 double-spaced pages, which is about 3,000 words. He then records it in the studio on the second floor of the headquarters building and mails the tapes of the program to the radio stations that carry it. Evelyn Hill posted on the National Alliance website, www.natvan.com, sends it to people on an email list and uses the scripts as the basis of a monthly subscription, $40 a year, desktop publication called Free Speech, sort of a newsletter. Evelyn finds pictures to accompany each of the four articles included in each Free Speech issue. When I am writing for a radio program, Pierce told me, I'm not as demanding as when I am writing for a magazine like National Vanguard. When I'm writing for print, I'm thinking people are going to be looking at this and that. Every word has to be right. People are going to be looking at this and every word has to be right. I can't have sloppy phrasing. But when I'm writing for the radio program, it is much more conversational. I repeat things for emphasis and I'm not so careful how I develop an idea. You have to be a little simpler in oral things because people can't go back and study the text and let the idea get into their heads. You've got to pound in what you say, so it has to be short and pungent. One day I was with Pierce when he recorded an American Dissident Voices program. He sat at his desk in his office and read the completed script out loud off his computer screen to proof it and to hear how it would sound when broadcast. He said that typically it takes him about 2 days to prepare a script. When he was satisfied with what he had put together, he printed a copy and took it upstairs to the recording studio, the only carpeted room in the headquarters building. He turned the dials on a large console which sits on a wooden table, clipped a microphone to his t-shirt, and sat down at what he calls his soundproof plastic chair, which I took to mean the one that doesn't creak. He said, bup, 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 to test the sound level, and he was set to go. Pierce sat on the plastic chair in his t-shirt, jeans, and work boots, with a gun strapped to his waist, and recorded the script he had written. He held the script in his left hand, a few inches from his face. With the first beat of the show, his persona changed. He went from being mature, sober, and rather kindly to, at least to my ears, loud, strident, and marginal sounding. I have always thought Pierce's radio shows read better than they sound. Now that's an interesting point. I always liked to read the ADVs that were circulated each Saturday morning, whereas a lot of people, when I would travel around the country, really enjoyed listening to them. But I found you could read them much more quickly. And for what Pierce said, I didn't find they're excellent, uniformly excellent. The best thing put out in America when he was alive, I would say. Certainly the best regular thing. Not long into the taping, Pierce stumbled over a word and reached forward and pushed a button and stopped the process. They give you the valuable context so that you know Pierce has done the work to explain to you truly what is going on in Rhodesia, you know, now Zimbabwe when he's doing the ADVs after 91. What is going on in South Africa? He always puts it in the right context. Pierce is the lone man doing what all journalism theoretically is doing. Not just giving you the facts of some particular story, but when it's more than an evanescent blip or a news peg, when there's actually something longer range going on there as opposed to some fire that just happened, it gives you the context so that you can see what it all means. Right? You don't just talk about this crime abstracted from everything else. You talk about this crime in the context of the law and the social policies and the other crimes of its type, crime in general, so that you truly understand where it fits in. I mean, that's the purpose of journalism. But Pierce is the only one doing it. Not long into the taping, Pierce stumbled over a word and reached forward and pushed a button and stopped the process. Oh, I don't know why I do this, he exclaimed. How does Brokaw do this? Then he started up again at that point. Another mistake. Oh, hell. Stop and begin again. Mistake. Oh, God. This went on until he finally got it recorded. The program Pierce recorded that day had to do with a crisis then going on. This was late 1997, over Iraq's refusal to permit a United Nations inspection team to check for biological and chemical weapons within its borders. Now he's got an extended quote here. In 1991, we bombed Baghdad and slaughtered more than 100,000 Iraqis because they had invaded Kuwait, which in fact used to belong to them before it was taken away during the colonial period. And then we imposed a crippling economic embargo on the defeated Iraqis, an embargo which has caused the deaths of an estimated 500,000 Iraqi infants and children during the past 6 years, and which is maintained because of Israeli insistence. So the Iraqis have plenty of reason to hate us now, but no reason to try to hurt us if we would leave them alone. Iraqi interests lie in the Middle East, and only in the Middle East. The reason we are headed toward another war with Iraq is solely because of the influence of the Jews on the government of the United States. It certainly isn't because we are concerned about Iraq's development of weapons of mass destruction. If we were serious about that sort of thing, we would have stopped Israel from developing its chemical, biological, and nuclear arsenal. The reason it's all right with our government for the Jews to have weapons of mass destruction, but not all right for the Iraqis to have them, is that the Jews control the news and entertainment media in the United States, and thus wield effective control over the political process, and the Iraqis don't. And that's the only reason. After Pierce records a program, he adds a pre-recorded, standard introduction which tells about the National Alliance, and an outro, an ending, that tells listeners how to contact the organization. Then he mails tapes to the stations who carry the program. Pierce recorded the program on Iraq, the one I observed, in the mid-afternoon. That evening at 7:30, he was listening to a playback of the tape in his office. From the expression on his face, he seemed pleased with how the program had turned out and was immersed in what he was doing. The intercom that he had set up with Irina at the trailer rang. He didn't answer it. Primarily through Evelyn Hill's efforts, a National Alliance website was established in the mid-1990s. Pierce reports that it now gets between 12 and 20,000 hits a day, which means that many times a day other computers make contact with his site. The Alliance website includes information about the organization and its publications, copies of Pierce's radio broadcasts, and ways to get in touch with the 20 or so local National Alliance units and make overseas connections, among them the National Democratic Party in Germany and the British National Party. The site also has a letters and browsers from browsers section, which includes letters and email messages praising Pierce and his message, as well as some scathingly critical of both. The criticisms he included in the letters from browser section when I checked it were all crude and vulgar condemnations. Hey, you white trailer trash. I mentioned to Pierce that I had read similar letters, except they were from the opposite perspective in a book I had just finished by Alan Dershowitz called Chutzpah. You are a commie-ass pinko shyster. Look, Pierce responded, that is a time-honored way to discredit people who oppose you. What you do is associate them with all the lowest among them. Dershowitz, in publishing those letters, makes it seem that anybody who opposes the Jews in any way is an ignorant bigot, and that stops the discussion in its tracks. This kind of thing was done particularly effectively during the Civil Rights Revolution in the 1950s and 60s. There were many thoughtful, upstanding people who opposed what was being done to America back then. For example, there was Carlton Putnam, the head of a major airline. But the media ignored him and focused instead on the slobs and the white trash and their reaction to what was going on. People would watch some lowlife guy with his face contorted with hatred, yelling ungrammatical curses at blacks and thought, I don't want to be associated with that guy. The guy doing the yelling saw his life threatened and did the only thing he knew how to do, but people watching the tube couldn't get beyond his style to what he was reacting against. We use the same technique when we publish letters on our website. There are a lot of very intelligent and literate people who oppose us, but the letters we publish are the ones that reveal hatred, warped minds, and so on. At present, the National Alliance is a dues-paying membership organization, with members paying $10 a month. Some members voluntarily contribute more than that. There are in the neighborhood of 20 local units, with leaders whom Pierce selects. Many of the Alliance's members are not part of local units, however. The Alliance's local units operate quite autonomously. Pierce doesn't really have the resources to oversee them. The vitality of a particular local unit is to a great extent a function of the capabilities of the unit leader. The units in Cleveland and Orlando have the reputation of being especially active units, with regular, well-attended meetings and organized functions, speakers, and celebrations, and so on. Pierce doesn't reveal the number of members in the National Alliance. My guess is that membership in the Alliance is in the 2,000 range, with its growth rate picking up in recent years. The two key people working alongside Pierce in the National Alliance Central Office are Bob DeMars and Evelyn Hill. Both are invaluable to Pierce, and both work long hours, and they can't be doing it for the money. I believe they draw salaries in the range of $1,000 a month, with no benefits. They may be getting some help from Pierce with housing. Bob had just built a house on the property when I arrived, and I don't know whether he has to pay any real estate taxes. Evelyn lives in the original farmhouse on the property, and it could be that she doesn't pay anything for that. I really don't know. I didn't talk with any of the principals about it. Whatever the case, Bob and Evelyn aren't getting rich working in far-right politics. Bob is a former marketing professor at Arkansas Tech University. He handles the business and marketing end of Pierce's operation. He has a doctorate from the University of Oklahoma. Bob had been with Pierce in West Virginia for a couple of years when I arrived. I stayed with Bob when I was at the property. His house is prefabricated. He told me that once a foundation was laid, a big crane set the house onto the foundation in sections. Bob's house is a very modest one, one floor of four small rooms. It has a walk-in basement, and Bob plans on putting a couple of rooms down there, which will make the house, in effect, two stories. A deck was partly completed when I was there. The features in Bob's house, woodwork, plumbing fixtures, and the rest, didn't strike me as exactly top of the line. Even though everything was new, during my stay, the toilet ran constantly and water leaked onto the floor. Bob was just settling into his new house when I was there, and the room which would have served as a living room was completely full of boxes, and the door was shut. So that left just the kitchen in Bob's bedroom and my bedroom. Two Siamese cats shared the house with us. They pretty much had the run of the place and spent a good deal of their time on the kitchen table and countertops. One of them would vomit in front of Bob's bedroom door to show his displeasure, Bob assumes, at Bob for having it closed and blocking his entry. Bob had to put an extra piece of carpeting in front of his door to protect the regular carpeting in that area from vomit stains. Yeah, I don't really get living with cats that are causing problems for you like that. Bob told me that Pierce had designated where he should put his house, which turned out to be about 100 yards to the left front of the headquarters building. Bob's house is on the edge of Pierce's property, and Bob had to buy some land from the owner of the adjacent property to get a place to put a water pump in. Bob had a late model white Chevy Blazer like Pierce's that I would see parked in front of the house. I associate the house with Bob's Blazer. On the front of the SUV, where a license plate would go, evidently you don't have to have a front license plate in West Virginia, was a National Alliance plate. On it was a life rune around which were the words National Alliance. At the bottom of the plate was a toward a new consciousness, a new order, a new people. Bob is tall, 6'2 or so, with short, neatly trimmed graying hair, which is receding in the front a bit and thinning. I think he said he was 51. He has a mustache and wears large wire-rimmed glasses. He has soft features and vaguely reminds me of Johnny Carson when Carson was his age. When I was there, Bob almost always dressed down in a t-shirt, jeans, and worn athletic shoes. He had on a gray suit at a conference held on the property when I was there, and he looked very distinguished in it. Bob has the build and movements of an ex-athlete. I can imagine him playing forward on his high school basketball team back in South Dakota where he grew up, although I don't know whether he or not he actually did. In manner, Bob is soft-spoken, polite, modest, respectful, self-effacing, and sincere. I was very touched by the consideration and kindness he showed me while I stayed with him. I didn't have to ask for things. Bob would be vigilant to what I needed, and he would go out of his way to provide it. Bob said he grew up in a My Three Sons world of, quote, two hardworking parents and nice kids. People stayed married where he was from when he was a kid, he said, and there weren't drugs or gangs, and there was very little illegitimacy. Adults around where he lived, Bob said, were oriented toward their children and the community, not narcissistically toward themselves. He said that a large group of boys in his neighborhood would get together on their own and play baseball. His sister was in a Brownie and Girl Scout troop. Bob truly believes that the way he grew up is natural to white people, and that they have been pushed away from their natural inclinations by alien, re-Jewish influence in the media and schools and elsewhere. Bob said he had heard one of Pierce's radio programs, quote, by accident, quote, and that what he had heard had struck home with him. He listened to a couple more programs, he told me, and then ordered some books through the National Vanguard book catalog and read for 2 weeks straight. After that, he was, quote, in, unquote. He told me that he feels that his life matters now that he has come to work with Pierce in West Virginia. Before, in his university teaching, he was training people to live in, as he put it, quote, a screwed-up world, unquote. He thinks that when it comes down to it, the research that he had been doing had been pointless, and as for the conferences, he would go to, quote, where everybody praised each other's work, unquote, an empty exercise. Bob spends hours upon hours each day in front of a computer screen as part of his job, but otherwise he largely rejects technology and modern culture. He hasn't seen television since 1992, as he considers it representative of values and ways, multicultural, liberal, Jewish, cosmopolitan, that are contrary to his beliefs. He asked me about the show Seinfeld, which he had heard about but never seen. Quote, Seinfeld is a Jew and plays a Jew, right? He asked me. Before I could answer, he added, and everybody on the show is a Jew, right? And then quickly, do they argue a lot? Evidently, he assumes that Jews argue a lot. Bob went on to say that he thought the Three Stooges acted like Jews. In fact, the four main leads on Seinfeld were written as Jews, but then they changed their names to give them non-Jewish names. But yeah, they were conceived as four Jews. But people like that on the Seinfeld show really do exist. I met some of them. I knew a woman very, very similar to Julie Louis-Dreyfus when I was in D.C. Although Seinfeld, of course, took place in New York. It's Bob's belief that we live in pseudo-sophisticated time, a pseudo-sophisticated time. He prefers the world of Zane Grey Western novels, he reads. He said that the old Western novels and films had straight-ahead good guys, bad guys, plots, and that they reflected a kind of elegant simplicity that he wants in his own life. He has a collection of old Western films, he told me, although I don't know when he gets to see them without a VCR. Bob reads a great deal, and I asked him what books he would recommend to me. He thought a second and then said, "Have you read Growth of the Soil by Newt Hamson?" I later checked on the book and Hamson. Hamson, H-A-M-S-U-N, K-N-U-T is first name. Newt Hamson was a Norwegian writer who was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. He wrote Growth of the Soil in 1921. It is one of the books that Pierce sells through the National Vanguard Books. Bob wrote the blurb for the book in the catalog. Here's the blurb for Newt Hamson's Growth of the Soil. Isaac, the central figure of the novel, at first appears to be a simple man. He searches the moors for good farmland and a good woman. Her name is Inger, and together they build and protect their farm and their family. There are 1,000 problems to solve, but Isaac's and Inger's strength, will, and intelligence solve most of them. Land and family, it's what we live for. It's part of the Aryan soul, our link to the past and to the future. Hamson is probably pronounced Hamsun in Norwegian, I would guess, since Norwegian is Germanic, although they certainly don't speak Norwegian. Hamsun, or Hamson, was prosecuted after World War II for encouraging his countrymen to cooperate with the Germans during the German occupation of Norway. A fine film, Hamson, with Max von Sydow in the title role, was released a few years ago and centered on this part of Hamson's life. I've never seen that. I'd like to see that. Hamson with Max von Sydow. Bob selects many of the books that are sold through the National Vanguard Books catalog. He told me a book for both children and adults he likes very much is Tarka the Otter by the English writer Henry Williamson. Tarka the Otter was written in 1917 and, as with Growth of the Soil, its author had problems on account of his sympathy for the Nazis. Williamson was arrested in 1940 for his opposition to the war with Germany. Bob is a lifelong bachelor and I think he has some regrets about that. He showed me a letter he had written to a woman in Florida responding to one she had written to the Alliance, asking what the organization was about and how it might make a difference to her life. Pierce had given Bob the letter and asked him to reply to her. Bob wrote a draft of a letter to her and showed it to me. And Pierce did that to me also, a guy who wrote him from Oregon who was going for a PhD in German studies. He asked me to take the letter and said he didn't have time to respond and would I respond to him. So that was a technique that Pierce used to use. Bob wrote a draft of a letter to her and showed it to me. In it, he talked about his own life. Quote, Over the last 30 years, he wrote, several of the women I met would have made wonderful wives and mothers, but I could feel the jaws of responsibility tightening around me. I knew I would be happier single, but I realize now that the only purpose of life is life. It isn't to go to heaven, as Christians believe, but to continue the chain of life. Babies are more precious than going to heaven. I want children to bring me pictures they have colored, and for their children to bring them pictures they have colored. I want this cycle to go on and on. I think Bob would very much like a wife and family to share his new home and new life in West Virginia. However, I don't know how good his chances are of meeting someone in this sparsely populated area in which he lives now. When Pierce gave Bob the woman's letter and asked him to write her, I wondered whether to any extent Pierce was playing matchmaker. Pierce had done that one time I know about for someone else who worked with him, a man named Kevin Strom. In that instance, Strom eventually married the letter writer. That would be Alicia. With a big question mark for her last name. O'Brien, Hawks. Bob has great admiration for Pierce. For one thing, he sees Pierce as a man's man. Bob told me it was too bad that I hadn't been at the property a few weeks earlier when they were building a structure at the top of the hill. He said that Pierce had shown great courage on that occasion, climbing around 12 feet above the ground. He also has high respect for Pierce's intellect and toughness and will. The only concern he has about Pierce that I picked up is that he worries that Pierce's heated rhetoric, all the references to violence and revolution, might be scaring off some people who might otherwise agree with the Alliance's perspective. I've lost touch with Bob since I left West Virginia. I have an image in my mind of this quiet man sitting alone at his kitchen table early in the morning, an open book and his yellow marking pen next to him, eating his sugar-frosted flakes. And then very late at night, after a long day at the headquarters building, again alone, the same book, the same marking pen, eating his TV dinner. I hope Bob is okay. Evelyn Hill's office is just across the hall from Pierce's, and from what I could see, she provides yeoman service to him. Evelyn manages the internet site for the National Alliance, handles all of its, which means Pierce's, correspondence, seeks out material from the web that she thinks might be useful to Pierce in putting together his radio program, and edits the monthly Alliance publication, Free Speech. It appeared to me that Evelyn doesn't quite match Pierce and Bob's 12 and 13-hour workdays, but I saw her in the headquarters building many a late evening when I was around. I had almost no personal contact with Evelyn. Whenever I have had any business with Pierce, when I was not in West Virginia, and have gone through Evelyn to get to him, she has proven to be very responsive and efficient. But when I was around the property, she never as much as looked at me. As I think about it now, I never saw her speak to anyone there about anything other than task-related matters. And yes, that's exactly the impression she gives off, and the way she acts, in my limited experience. I've not found Griffin to be wrong about any particular thing. So, I have found him to be right about every particular thing. Although I have a couple different interpretations of where interpretations come into play. Evelyn seemed to be there to get things done, period. And she did get things done. I had exactly one face-to-face exchange with Evelyn. One afternoon, a couple of days before I was scheduled to leave the property, I stood in the doorway of my office and asked if I could snap a picture of her. I held up my small camera and said, "Could I take your picture, Evelyn?" She looked up from her desk, and for the first time that I know of, she laid eyes on me. She replied politely but very firmly, "No, I don't photograph well." And that was that. Evelyn lives alone in the original farm home on the property. I don't know very much about her background. I believe she has a doctorate in pharmacology, and that she worked as a pharmacist in Washington State before she came to West Virginia in 1996. I think she made contact with Pierce through one of the biannual leadership conferences he hosts on the West Virginia property. One experience involving Evelyn I'll always remember brought home to me that even radical politics is a job like any other. Evelyn has rheumatoid arthritis. One day I was in Pierce's office, and Evelyn brought up her lack of health insurance and her concerns about what will happen to her if her arthritis gets worse. In her loud, somewhat coarse voice, she said to Pierce, "I suppose if I get really bad, you'll just throw away my stuff on the lawn out front and get rid of me." Pierce replied matter-of-factly, "I'll do whatever is best for the Alliance." Pierce told me he considers the National Alliance to be the only serious, mature, radical, right-wing organization in America, and views it as being equivalent to the National Democratic Party in Germany and the British National Party. Pierce told me that he maintains contacts with the NPD, whose chairman is Udo Voigt, V-O-I-G-T, and the British National Party, led by John Tyndall. He says he has no contact with the National Front in France, whose most prominent figure is Jean-Marie Le Pen. He says he considers Le Pen to be more of a populist than a racial nationalist. Boy, what would he say about Marine, huh? During one of my visits to the property in the spring of 1998, Pierce showed me a snapshot of a rally of the NPD in the town of Passau, Germany, he had attended earlier that year. It was on February 7th, the NPD's Day of National Resistance. There were 6,600 people in present, Pierce told me, 6,600 people present on the National Day of Resistance put on by the NPD in Passau, Germany, in spring of 1998. The people in the photo looked young, in their 20s, working class, and about two-thirds of them were male. Pierce told me that one of the issues facing people of his political stripe in Germany, as well as here in this country, is to find ways to get through to the educated middle classes who he believes are armored against any social or political ideas they are told are unacceptable. German meeting halls have rows of tables and benches rather than seats. Pierce was scheduled to speak at the Passau rally. The tables were full and people were standing along the walls. It was the biggest meeting in the NPD since 1970 and the largest nationalist meeting of any kind in Germany in the last decade. Writing about the day in an Alliance membership bulletin, Pierce reported that as he approached the hall, quote, there was an extremely heavy police presence with literally hundreds of green vans bearing the word Polizei in large letters patrolling the streets of the town in the vicinity of the hall. Polizei, of course, being German for police. They expected and got anti-fascist demonstrations. Pierce took his place at the speaker's table. Shortly before he was scheduled to speak, a plainclothes police officer informed Pierce that if he rose to speak, he would be arrested and the meeting would be shut down. So Pierce didn't deliver the speech he had prepared. He told me that he was the only speaker who was banned from addressing those who had assembled that day. Pierce says the nationalist sentiment is growing in Germany and that it is really upsetting, quote, the couch potatoes, the establishment, and the Jews. He said besides the NPD, there is the DVU, the German People's Union, which has recently won some local elections. He said that the growing nationalist feeling is partly due to the economic difficulties some people are experiencing, but that more than anything, it is coming from the sense that people have that Germany is losing its soul. Did you ever see the film Cabaret? He asked me. It is a perfect example of what is happening now. This was back in the Weimar period, and there was all this decadence, the idea that enjoyment is the only thing that counts, and there was this slick, over-sophisticated, smart-ass cafe society that was taking over Germany then, just as it is taking over Germany now. There's a basic gut reaction people are having over there that this isn't the way we are supposed to behave. This isn't what really counts. Where are our basic values? Where are our traditions? This is what the nationalist impulse is about. The Home Secretary in Britain has informed Pierce that he will not be admitted into that country. However, the rumor when I was in West Virginia was that Pierce somehow sneaked into Britain after he left Germany and conferred with Tyndall and the other BNP leaders. When I was with him, Pierce was contacted a couple of times by European journalists seeking out his views. On one occasion, he gave a phone interview to a French reporter who wanted his thoughts on Le Pen and the National Front. Another time, he received a call from a reporter from the large-circulation German magazine, Der Spiegel, who wanted to come to West Virginia to interview Pierce for the magazine and German television. She said she wanted to get his take on what was going on in Germany and to learn about the status of white nationalist sentiment in the United States. The reporter filmed the interview with an American film crew after I left. While I was still around, Pierce was looking forward to her visit, but expressed concern about how objectively his ideas would be relayed by the German media. He told me later that, unfortunately, his concern was unwarranted. And with that ends the chapter of National Alliance, page 127. So we see how people built it up. We get little thumbnails of Evelyn Hill and Bob DeMars. We see what life is like there on the plantation. And we see how Pierce goes about putting together his ADV. And we see that he's involved a little bit internationally. I want to thank you for listening to me today. Everything that we do, as always, can be found at vnnforum.com for all perpetuity until we win. And my name is Alex Linder. If you're unfamiliar with me or just hearing this because someone circulated it to you, perhaps on Twitter, I thank you again for listening to me, and I'll be back again with you real soon.